once again we caution you, these stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
This is gold, Mr. Bond. All my life I've been in love with its color, its brilliance, its divine heaviness. I welcome any enterprise that will increase my stock, which is considerable.
I think you've made your point, Goldfinger. Thank you for the demonstration.
Choose your next witticism carefully, Mr. Bond. It may be your last. The purpose of our two previous encounters is now very clear to me. I do not intend to be distracted by another. Good night, Mr. Bond.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to me about that I don't already know.
This is the Bonus Patera Podcast. I'm Tom Carnell.
And I'm Langley West.
And Heather is away on redshirt business, yes?
Yes.
So we're going to just be the two of us.
Yeah.
For episode 88.
It's cozy. It's
yeah,
cool.
Right?
It's like a fireside chat.
It's just us and the dogs that are over.
Only
on the
today
couch.
It's just more like burning under the, you know, the
Washingtonian sun.
Yeah, the Washingtonian sun, which to us, is, or to me, is like hell.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
You just came from Vegas, though.
I know.
Yeah, anyway. Episode 88, we're here to discuss the supervillain.
Yeah.
I have a definition here from Wikipedia.
What is a supervillain?
Supervillain is a variant of the villainous stock character archetype commonly found in American comic books, films, and sometimes possesses superhuman abilities. I think we have two visions of the supervillain.
Uh-huh.
Number one, all the nonsense going on in the Marvel and the DC universe.
Sure.
And then we've got the big elephant in the room on this one is Bond films.
Sure.
The supervillain, it's sort of archetyped in, like, Dr. Evil, for example, in Austin Powers.
Right. I mean, if we look at the idea of a villain, just a villain. I mean, he's there to provide a foil for the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's not always there. Sometimes it's, you know, a story is, you know, man against nature or man against himself or something like that. But for a more, I don't know, traditional story where we got a bad guy, mm-hmm. there's a good guy and a bad guy. That's where the villain comes from. And the fact that he's a super villain to me implies that
It
implies that this is someone who, it's not like a Norman Bates character who mm-hmm. just has some problems and is affecting a very small sphere. He has a very small sphere of influence. He's killing these people right around him. No, a supervillain is somebody who is concerned with a more universal evil, somebody who's out to destroy the world. Or,
right. It's the kind of shit that gets aped on Venture Brothers.
Right.
And it's the kind of shit that gets aped pretty heavily in, like, Despicable Me.
Sure.
Someone whose job it is, when he punches the clock, it's to do evil.
So often.
Or for personal gain.
Right,
or
right.
All that stuff.
So often, the word mastermind is used when you're talking about a supervillain. This is somebody with, as you pointed out, extraordinary abilities. Somebody who just as easily could have been a superhero.
Mm-hmm.
But
something happened in the past
yes.
that turned them.
Yes.
As much as I hate saying this, to the dark side.
Yes, to the dark side.
But again, the elephant in the room is all of the Bond stuff, which I was shocked looking over all of those.
Sure.
Number one, how much Ernst Stavro Blofeld gets used, you know, especially a lot of the earlier films.
Right.
And then later, how they really went for broke for like almost villain of the day of the week. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right, right.
And it isn't until Spectre that we see Blofeld come back.
Right.
But Blofeld is kind of the guy that everyone thinks about. You know, big chair, petting the cat.
Right, right. You know? Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's the model.
Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the, you know, that Blofeld is the model for, I would argue that Dr. No is, because he was the first
He was the first.
Yeah.
Although they kind of, remember, like, they always had Ming would be, Emperor Ming would be a supervillain.
Right.
But predating the Bond
yeah,
stuff.
All of this,
but,
yeah.
But like that, and then before that, we've got sort of this mustache twirling.
Yeah. Snidely Whiplash.
Snidely
type,
Whiplash, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah
type
yeah.
character, yeah. But again, not a supervillain. I wouldn't classify
Snidely Whiplash.
Yeah,
guys
of his ilk. You know, he's just out to
a villain. But in the world that they're portraying in the Old West, that is
sure.
I mean, the dominance of a territory is enough.
That's
that
true.
Is world domination
because that was their world.
Right. But it's always not always, but sometimes it's like this large part of a larger thing, like in Blofeld's case, Inspector,
right,
and remember Chaos with
yes.
JetSmart, yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
this organization, like they've got secretaries.
There's
in
always
a typing pool,
an acronym.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, or it alludes to something. Like for example, they're not quite super villains, but the Hand in Daredevil.
Right.
You know, this organization, or like the League of Shadows in Batman.
Right.
Or what have you. But it's like this organization.
It's like the Mafia.
Yeah.
But.
But with matching outfits.
And science.
Yeah. And science. Well, you know, it's like, again, we, you know, we talked about a lot of this stuff on our spy show, but like our man Flint. You
right.
know, they all the enemies always seem to dress this. They all went the same tailor,
yeah.
and they all had like a uniform. And
yeah.
again, it gets aped so perfectly in stuff like Austin Powers,
The Incredibles.
Yeah, yeah. I just read an article about this guy talking about how the best Fantastic Four movie ever made is The Incredibles.
Totally,
yeah.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah,
I've said that before. When I was a little kid, there were always. Like I always lived in rural areas, but out on the edge of the horizon at nighttime, there was always some plant, some factory, and in my mind, that was always manned by like these guys
yeah.
in like, you know, like a red jumpsuit, you
yeah.
know, and they all
walking around with like, remember those old grease guns that you
yes.
had back
yeah,
in the 40s?
Yeah.
Walking around patrolling the area.
And I always imagined there was like some evil mastermind, usually a gorilla, I don't know why,
yeah.
wearing a hard hat. And he was like kind of like controlling the whole thing. He had a clipboard.
Yeah. and like, what do you do when you're buying your secret hideaway? Do you go, I really need one with a skull, a mountain that looks like a skull. Yeah.
That's why this stuff is so great for comedy, because
it's so broad.
It's so broad, and you look at within the context of these films, they make perfect sense. But then when you stop and you think about the logistics, it's like,
yeah.
who's the contractor that you get to make your giant, you know, wall that separates?
It's
so
like,
that,
yeah.
You
it's
know.
Like I've always had a problem with like the Batcave. It's like, again, not to channel Kevin Smith, but who do you hire for that?
Right.
Is it like, you know, independent contractors? Is it
exactly?
Yeah.
It's the Death Star thing, right? It's
yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's like,
that's what I'm saying, Kevin Smith.
Are, yeah.
But the idea is like a simple thing. I was watching the Comic-Con footage from Justice League, and there's the introduction of the Flash, and you don't care about any of this. But at one point, Bruce Wayne whips out a batarang and throws it, and the Flash sort of slows time down and plucks it out of the air, right? And I just thought to myself, where do you get a fucking batarang made? Like, how do you keep that on the low?
Wait, wasn't that covered in one of these Christian Bale movies? They had like some Chinese company they would send the specs to.
But still, like there's the in the days of the internet, it's like, hey, you know those things we're making for that crazy American guy? Fucking Batman has them. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but it's that it's really, as we said before, that broad brush. There's right. an evil guy, and he lives on an island, and then someone had to make it work.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I for me, the elephant in the room when we start talking about supervillains, and at first I wasn't going to talk about this because I thought it was too, it's almost like saying Hitler, right? It's just too, it's like too on the nose, you know?
Yeah.
Is Satan. Because Satan
he's got his hidden fortress.
Yeah, he's got his minions.
Wow. Now there's your first supervillain.
Yeah, right? Because, and he is in this position because of something that happened in his past. You know, his pride has resulted in him. And I've always kind of seen him as the necessary half of a whole, right? You know?
Yeah.
You know, what good is, you know, goodness if there is right. no darkness to...
It's all balance and
yeah,
polarities.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Good and bad, hot and cold.
Yeah, all that stuff. So, I think the thing that's fascinating about Satan as a villain, and I'm not even talking about Satan as a villain in the Bible. I'm talking about like literature, Milton,
yeah, sure.
you know, Paradise Lost, this type of thing.
And The Exorcist.
Yeah, exactly. Is that there's so many characters in film and literature that are basically extensions of, or personifications of, or
mm-hmm.
You know, the Jesus to Satan. It's like
Rumble.
Satan in human form.
So,
for example, Randall Flagg.
Sure.
Would be an example.
Or more, even more on the nose is like the prophecy.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. yeah. Where we have this otherwise human character, but because of their, their connection with the devil, are able to do extraordinary things. Mm-hmm. They, you know, and we're not even sure if they're real.
And even if that devil goes by another name, the generic evil,
right?
You know,
exactly.
We're out to do evil or
right.
whatever.
I mean, Sauron. What is Sauron if he's not Satan?
Yeah, you absolutely.
Know? Yeah,
absolutely. You know? I've never understood that. It seems just as silly to me as the going the other way. You know, it's like
sure.
you're still buying into the same myth construct, but it's just going the other way.
That's what always kind of drove me nuts about, like, you know, self-proclaimed Satanists who, you know, would say that they don't believe in God.
Mm.
And I'm like,
yeah,
you can't
have one without the other.
It's not like a buffet where you can pick and choose. You know, the food you're going to eat. You either buy in or you don't.
Well, that's a whole other
show.
And one that would probably get us visited in the night by black guys, I mean, guys in black robes. Or the other big one that sort of, you know, in that comic world is like Lex Luthor.
Right.
He's the big bad.
You know,
there.
And that's something too, is that sometimes it isn't that they have some type of extraordinary ability
mm-hmm.
or power, they have money.
Right.
And that...
It's Batman in reverse.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing I like about the Satan model is that there doesn't have to be any kind of... it's what I like and don't like about it, is that there doesn't have to be any kind of a justification for the evil deeds that they're doing. They're just evil.
Yeah.
They're just evil for evil's sake. You know, what's the line from Dark Knight? You know, some men just want to watch the world burn.
Sure.
I think that's cool. That's a very cool idea. But I think it's also, it can be bad because now we have no real... I think it's more interesting when we have a motivation for the bad guy. There's a reason.
Generic evil... It just doesn't work in a real world thing.
No, but it's frightening.
Yeah, well, the idea that someone would see that, be given the choice and to choose, you know,
that.
In some usually self-serving sort of vindication of some past wrong.
So, like somebody like Randall Flagg. Yeah. Like, we're never really given a reason as to why he's...
He just is.
He's not collecting souls. He's not... You know what I mean? He's just... Right. He just is bad. He's like... It's like, look, I'm the decay in this tooth. And
that's the Bill Moseley line about I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But again, that I mean, that has within it a really deep and dark well that can be plumbed for all sorts of nice things. But on the other hand, I also feel like it's a cop out, as opposed to providing your character with something sufficient in their past to warrant the destruction of the world and of mankind. I mean, what a pissy move that is, right? I'm going to destroy everything. I'm going to destroy all the toys.
Right. And it might be, you know, and I think it's cool when that spark that started that is something that would be inconsequential to someone else.
Right.
You know, like, I've always liked it when we find, when the reveal happens and we find out why the villain is doing this, it's because he got he lost picked on ball. When he was, exactly, yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I find from a creative's standpoint is that this piece I'm working on now has to do with the devil. And what the funnest part of it in the writing of it is that the arrogance that you can put down on paper because you're voicing the voice of the demon or whatever.
Right.
You could say outlandish.
Sure.
Fucked up shit.
You can go into,
and it's fine.
You can go into Trumpville.
Yeah.
And not.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there is an inherent, I mean, imagine being Satan. It's like the arrogance there. Which
sure.
And that it would have to be there because of the idea that you're that's, bad, that's and what, that's the thing that feeds all that.
And that's what got him into trouble in the first place.
Right.
Was his arrogance, his pride, his vanity. Yeah. I'm hot shit.
Yeah. Before we get off the evil, what I call the evil overlord.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw out a personal favorite and both of ours, and that's Han from Han's Island on Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
Not quite a super villain, but meets a lot of the qualifications.
Absolutely.
Has minions, has a secret hideout, has this whole thing.
Lives on an island.
Right.
Runs this crime syndicate, these crime operations out of his and uses this martial arts tournament as cover
to recruit.
Recruit.
Yeah. Talent. He's trying to recruit badasses.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, you come right out of a comic.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But he's a guy who is all too human.
Yes.
But still, there's this foundation and there's this money
and has it, despite the unrealistic nature of it, has this extraordinary ability as well.
Mm-hmm.
He controls all this stuff. He's got all this money, but he's also a badass.
Yeah.
He's the only guy in the movie that can give our hero run for his money.
And who saw that coming? An old man with one hand suddenly whipping ass on Bruce Lee.
Of course, he has to resort to, you know, trickery. He's like, I'm putting my knives on.
But on the other hand, you know, we could go into a whole sidebar on dirty fighting. But
it's true.
Yeah,
it's
exactly. True. You kind of look at Han and go, well, fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Nature took my hand, or something took my hand. Why wouldn't I replace it with something?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's it, you know, that, and that's a common trope too. And I'm not sure if it's a trope that it makes me feel uncomfortable. It's so often the bad guy has some malady, some deformity, some
scar down the face.
Yeah, scar down the face.
He's in a wheelchair. He's
got one wide eye.
Or yeah. He always has some physical.
I always feel bad for the guy, right?
What was the guy? Wasn't there a guy in one of the latter Bond movies that had diamonds in his face?
I don't know.
I want to say that.
I don't watch the latter Bond.
I know,
movies.
Me neither. Well, no. I actually do. I have been pretty good. I mean, I've seen them, the Roger Moore films, but I really hate the Roger Moore films. just because I think it's
too silly.
Yeah, it's very too silly. And we will, I'm sure one day,
very campy.
We kind of did a Bond show before.
Well,
but
we did a spy show.
But specifically a Bond thing to go into. A friend of mine this weekend is having a Bond marathon.
A Bondathon.
Bondathon. And he's rating everything on Facebook as, you know, 003 out of 007.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, it's kind of fun. Those things are fun when you sit there and you just power down. I just read a great story in Kevin Pollak's book about during the making of A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
All of the cast. Now think about that. Demi Moore and Bruce Willis, Jack Nicholson, Tom Cruise, you know, had a, on a weekend, they had a Godfather party where they all sat around and watched The Godfather 1, took a break and had a big Italian meal, and then watched Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine sitting in that room.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
That would have been cool.
Very cool. That book is actually, I thought it was going to be just really light, but he's got some great stories just being in the room at certain moments. It's great. Another one that is a little out of the box that I want to mention, another supervillain, if you think about it, the Mad Scientist, aka not quite, doesn't fit all of our criteria, but
right.
He has an infrastructure. He's doing something that may not start out evil as Frankenstein, but he definitely is trying to manipulate,
right,
quote unquote, God's plan.
And I'd say that Frankenstein is our model for that. I mean, at least the modern version. I'm sure there's alchemists in literature.
Well, you've got Sauron's buddy is kind of a
Saruman.
Yeah, whatever. That fucking shit is.
Yeah, the guy with the robes.
The guy, there, Christopher Lee.
Yeah,
with the weird affect.
Yes,
on his voice.
Yes.
But other than that, you know, dealing in science and blah blah blah. Yeah, Frankenstein's your man. It was funny in looking at that, I was desperately trying to find other examples. And there are, for a film or two, or here or there, Dr. Pretorius, for example, which is kind of an offshoot in Bride of Frankenstein.
Right.
But I stumbled upon one that I just love. I'm going to talk about it real quickly. Professor Montgomery Weirdo, with his assistant Count Kook, from the cartoon Milton the Monster. Milton the Monster TV, kind of an afternoony Saturday morning cartoon about a mad scientist who makes a Frankenstein monster, but gets heavy-handed with a quote-unquote tincture of tenderness. So the guys are Frankenstein's really lovable.
Uh-huh.
It's a cartoon kind of version of Herman Munster,
okay,
in a weird way. Made notable by its B feature, which was something called Fearless Fly, about a fly that when he put on these certain glasses, he became essentially Superman. Made famous for the line, "My glasses."
Wait. Are you saying he became Superfly?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was very much a knockoff of Superfly. And this is Fearless Fly.
Cool.
But other than that, I couldn't really find too much as far as the mad scientist. But I do think that he deserves mentioning.
Yeah, he does. And a good example, I think, would be Dr. Cyclops. It's the guy that shrunk people down.
Yeah. Was that the Incredible Puppet People?
I can't. I don't know.
Yeah.
The guy, the bald guy with the the super thick glasses.
The big glasses.
Here again, somebody who's afflicted, obviously, in some way. The poor guy can't see.
Yeah.
Which makes no sense that he would make things smaller.
You would think he would make everything bigger just so he could make it out.
Yeah,
that's weird. But again, it's the conceit of changing the course of not only human events, but of the fabric of the universe itself.
Right. I think Mary Shelley's whole idea behind Frankenstein is he's more of a Prometheus character, hence the original title, where he's like, it's hubris, right? It's hubris. It's like, I'm stealing the fire from the gods. It's not fair that they have this control over life and death,
right,
when we... when it's within our grasp, you
know? It's the line that was cut from the original Frankenstein, the "now I know what it means to be God."
Right.
Because, you know, as they propose, there are some things that we don't need to know.
Right, exactly.
Which is
the
nonsense.
Whole, you know, the whole playing God.
Yeah.
I would also, you know, I just organically from our conversation, it's occurring to me, but I can't cite any examples off the top of my head. And I'm sure everyone, all three of you listening, can school me on this immediately. But God as supervillain. It's not sure. A traditional...
In Noah, view. He's certainly a dick.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and
the story of Noah and the story of Jonah, he's kind of a dick.
Yeah, and in things like...
Lot?
Preacher.
Oh.
Where...
I was still going to riff on you, beat up on the Bible. No, go ahead.
Well, in things like Preacher, where his... And this has been a trope in a few modern stories... Where he kind of checks out. He's like, I'm done. Throws his hands in the air and goes hiding. You know,
Sandman, that
and,
happens.
Yeah, exactly.
God goes missing.
And in something like Preacher, the impossible happens and God is punished for being a coward, essentially.
Mm.
And his cowardice is what makes him villainous in that story.
Right.
And right. But and just because he's who he is, that's thereby a supervillain.
Yeah, because you know, it's when, you know, he works in mysterious ways.
Yes.
Gets kind of vindictive.
Yeah.
Like look at Lot's wife.
Sure,
it's
sure.
Like, you know, it could be argued, I told you not to look back, but it's like, come on, yeah. You're burning a town. You expect the curiosity you gave us not to look back.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It is. It's a dick move to say.
It's a dick move
to give you free will, and then say, if you do this though,
I'm
gonna spank you hard.
Here's a world of shit
that
you can amuse yourself with, except I'm gonna put this thing.
Except for when I say you can't.
Except I'm gonna put this thing down there. By the way, this one thing. That you can't touch the tree of knowledge, and it's like knowing that is that as little monkeys that we are, the idea of course we're that's the first place we're going.
Absolutely, like if it that's a different again
another one that I thought of that has that same kind of hubris, and this is admittedly a stretch. Beetlejuice.
Sure.
Beetlejuice wants to change the way the fabric of life and death works by taking over, essentially.
Right.
He's
incompetent and a buffoon.
And a buffoon. And the thing that made his ailment, his scar on the face, is his ego and the idea that, you know, to steal Prometheus's fire, right? Is to do exactly that.
He fits the criteria because he has abilities. He has these
absolutely
uncommon abilities.
And ends up having a lair by default where he's banished to becomes, you know, he turns the model.
Right.
The brothel in the model.
Right.
And that kind of thing.
He's a fun supervillain.
Yeah.
As they often are.
They're the best parts
to
have. Because the bad guy, again, he's got this character motivation where the good guy is usually generically good.
Any actor will tell you that it's far more fun to play a bad guy than it is to play the good guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, even if you're playing a good guy, like, play the anti-hero. Play the flawed hero.
My dogs are about to bark.
That's
so. Excuse us for that.
They're thinking about.
Yeah, there's someone outside.
Thinking
there
about.
They're
convinced there's a villain outside.
Yeah, they're waiting. Yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
Now, kind of this kind of model kind of fits both all of these criteria of like mad scientist, the evil, you know, mastermind of this organization, etc. And that would be Moriarty. Professor Moriarty from Sherlock Holmes, which I was shocked. I didn't realize that he only appears in two Holmes stories, in the Doyle books, but has since become like the foil. Anytime anybody does something about Sherlock Holmes, you're going to be talking about Moriarty.
Right. It's the back to the venture idea, the idea of having an arch.
Right.
An arch enemy, nemesis.
Someone who is on par with your genius or your ability or your money or whatever it is that makes you a superhero, right? They're right there with you. Maybe even better. Maybe even smarter.
Batman Joker comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Every bit. They always talk about the duality of Batman and the Joker. Again, there's that balance, the stuff.
Yeah, Moriarty was based on a few real life characters, not so much for their evilness, even though they were often cited as kind of dicks, but more for their genius. I can't remember names right now, but there was an astronomer that came to mind. There was a guy that actually was kind of an evil mastermind in England, and I wish I could remember the name.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, it was first examples of a lot of that stuff. I mean, but it was still just taking. It still goes back to what you're saying about God and Satan.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of kind of equal powers, you know,
right?
Which doesn't make sense, in if you think about it. But the but what a footprint that character makes.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, and leads to characters later on that may not be...
But do we remember him mostly because of the fact that he's involved in what we assume to be...
Sure. Well, he was... And that's why he was created, because they had to come up... Doyle had to come up with someone who would be capable of killing Holmes.
Yeah.
Because he's shown us time and time again that, you know, your average dude isn't going to be able to pull it off.
Able to kill him.
Right.
And how great it is, again, to, you write, you close the book, so to speak, but it's, you know, it could still be revisited.
Yeah.
There's a great duo of books by a guy named Mark Frost. One's called The List of Seven, and the other one's called Six Messiahs. It talks about Holmes meeting a fictional basis for Doyle meeting a fictional basis for Holmes.
Oh, cool.
And they're really, really good. Mark Frost wrote Twin Peaks.
I was going to say Mark Frost of Twin Peaks, right?
Yeah. They're really good.
Cool.
Very daring do, very sort of Indiana Jones meets...
Oh, cool.
Stuff. It's great.
I love that stuff.
They're great.
Put somebody in a bowler or a top hat. I'm there.
Yeah, on top of a train.
Yeah.
Another name that came to mind, I thought, initially was Vader.
Sure.
Then I thought, really, Vader's just a super powerful minion.
Right.
It's the Emperor that is the supervillain.
Absolutely.
Because he's the one that is... so to speak, pulling the strings.
Right. And, Vader as... I see the Emperor as Satan and Vader as Randall Flagg.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. Very much so. But it's interesting because when you talk villains, Vader's name always comes up. But he's really kind of inept.
He's not only...
He can't get the Death Star built.
As so often...
He gets it blown up twice.
Well, here's the thing, is that so often, real-life supervillains, like Hitler, are inept. It's kind of their sheer exuberance, their enthusiasm, that kind of carries them as far as it does before things start to break down.
It reminds me of the Carlin bit about the flamethrower, about how someone goes, man, you know, he'll bring up the idea. him being Hitler, mm-hmm. bringing up an idea of, you know, I wish I could throw flame on that guy.
Right.
And it would have ended there, except he set it around his friend who was good with tools.
Right.
And he came back like, quite an idea you have there, right? Same sort of thing with Hitler. Like, he's just talking his shit in a coffee house at some point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But somebody else is like, hey.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
The manager or the agent or someone is like, we could turn a coin on this guy.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, you got a problem.
Hitler's like, we need to kill all these people. Here's this guy that's like, hey.
Hey.
I know how to do that.
That would certainly clear up the workforce. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. And
it's horrible, but it is true.
It's. I think that Vader is a good example of kind of reflecting how in real life these cats kind of are.
Yeah.
They're successful, and it starts to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because at some point...
Hitler is supervillain. It kind of like the Third Reich kind of fell apart. We keep coming back to a couple of biggies here. It's weird.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's very much so. They have it together. Dr. Evil has it together.
Yeah.
And then through, you know.
Either ineptitude. Usually through ineptitude. It's like at some point they start.
Or malfeasance of the hero. Yeah. Or
writing checks that they can't cash.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or because the hero, they have a perfectly good plan and the hero comes in and mucks it up.
Sure. The hero, I think a lot of times the hero is kind of a monkey wrench in the machine that may start this breakdown, but ultimately the breakdown happens because...
Well, there's obviously, in a lot of these things, there are design flaws. Like, you just don't ever build the one button that's going to explode the entire island.
Why would you have that button?
Why would you have that? And why would you put it in, so big so everyone can see it? Yeah, yeah.
Like a big... Do not touch this button.
Under any circumstances.
This is the one, but this is the tree of knowledge that you must stay away from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how does someone not push that button?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen, I remember a cartoon about there's a big red button, right? And it's like, you know, whatever you do, don't touch the button. And then that character goes away and then the guy's sitting there and he's like, his fingers shaking. He's like, you don't want to touch this button, but my hand is.
It's that
this
monkey
button.
Curiosity,
absolutely.
Right? Absolutely, which makes Darth Maul a minion.
Yeah,
really, if you think about it.
Yeah, Darth Maul's like, you know, he's cooler than everybody else, but he's small potatoes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what a cool character that was. And Ray Park knocked it out of the park. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, geez, it's like with this new thing. Did you see the Rogue One footage? Where this is a sidebar. Rogue One footage was released, and Donnie Yen is some major Jedi badass.
Is he a Jedi or a bad guy?
I don't know. He was, with the scene I saw, he was slaughtering stormtroopers.
Oh, okay, so he's
but he's got these like white eyes, and it's Donnie Yen, for fuck's sake. Like, why wouldn't you put that? I would back. I mean, like,
you know, that's the one thing. I was gonna say that's the one thing that I've kind of, even as a kid, when the first Star Wars came out, because I read this big long thing about comparing the Jedi to samurai.
Sure,
this is before I saw the movie, and I was really excited because I kind of pictured this big martial arts thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then another article that compared the Force to Chi. And it was drawing all these parallels between, you know, real life martial arts and what was happening in this fantasy world.
Fanboys.
And I was disappointed that, you know, we got fight scenes that were put together by... albeit, you know, one of the great, you know, swords masters, choreographers, but it wasn't what I was picturing. I was picturing, you know.
If anything, I would argue that instead of the Jedi being warriors, samurai, Klingons.
Mm.
That's a martial culture.
Oh, sure.
That's I think is closer to the samurai ethic than Jedi. Jedi, I think, are a balance for the greed and the
Sure.
Everything of mankind who, you know, who wants...
Wanted to see somebody doing some badass sword stuff.
Yeah, and you kind of did, considering that it was, you know, David Prowse and Mark Hamill.
Sure.
They had maybe, what, 6 weeks to train.
Right,
but it would have been nicer to see... have you ever seen... The name's escaping me, but the Viggo Mortensen swordsman movie? A la Triste? You want to say what it's called?
No.
Yeah, me neither. It's out there, and I saw it being made. But there's a guy who has trained under enough swords people to know a thing or two about a thing or two when it comes to swordsmanship. Another name that comes to mind, Ra's al Ghul.
Oh.
Yeah. Fits all of our criteria. Has a world organization, has a secret lair. Has a secret lair that rejuvenates, you know, he so he can never die.
Yeah.
And he's got a fun name. And by extension of that, Talia al Ghul, his daughter. Are
these comic book characters?
These are all Batman foils. So no, they're not comic books. They're more like parables. Myths on how to mold one's life.
Wait, no, is this, was he the,
He's the guy the Lazarus Pit that would, he was the one that trained him. League of Shadows.
He's Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's Liam Neeson. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And again, the more I think of it, I made some other notes here, but some of these names in for film villains, I'm starting to now question about their status. For example, Agent Smith in The Matrix, I think, is a minion, the more I think about it, to the main programmer. Who's the supervillain?
Sure, although I would say that the main programmer is so far removed that I don't think there's necessary villainy there.
Mm-hmm.
Like
no more villainy than God.
Yeah, he's just kind of doing
what
he... Okay. But Smith develops feelings.
Yeah, into one.
And
he's not just an agent of chaos.
Right.
At that point. At the point that he decides the speech about mankind being an infection.
A virus needs to be eradicated. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's
now he's
personally
super
invested. Yeah, and he's like... Like, at that point, I think if the programmer had just gone away or had changed the program, I think at this point Smith is like, no, fuck you.
I'm Neo, he's breaking boundaries now. He's becoming, he is code. And so he's seeing life as code.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a couple of other names. Someone argued, in a conversation I had, Khan from Star Trek, the Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's genetically modified. He's stronger than most folks.
Mm-hmm.
So he does have the special abilities thing.
Yeah.
He is a foil for our hero. Sure. You know, it gets to that weird line because, you know, like we made this restriction on ourselves to do supervillains, and it's hard because, like you pointed out with the early Westerns and stuff, like a villain... can be a supervillain. If you live in a town of, 100 people, it's easy to become like the most evil man in that world. Right?
I have a example of that.
Yeah.
Wicked Witch of the West.
Sure.
Within the construct of that world, she's about as bad as it gets.
Yes.
And she has her own agenda. She has her own hidden lair. She has her own minions.
Yeah.
She has a superpower.
Yeah, absolutely. She totally.
But it speaks to what you were saying. Like within the again, we always get nuts and boltsy, writery stuff. But it's like within that construct, it's what drives me so crazy with a lot of modern cinema is that your first act is setting up of the rules.
Right.
Second act is going to be conflict, something that either you're questioning those rules in that construct, or you're reaffirming it, or what have you, and then the idea of your conclusion being, how did it all turn out?
You're either returning to status quo, or you've moved on to a new
And so, are somehow changed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the idea that within that first part, that world building that we talk about,
right?
Once you set up for example, the Lilliputians, Oz is the universe, and
right.
And so within that construct, you have to. It's what I consider my niche, is taking a ridiculous idea, and then once you have that ridiculous idea locked in, you put the screws to it, and you make it fit to that first world building.
Right.
You can't change the rules as midway, which while it can be argued, like in The Shining, that which was forgotten
is
the key. That gets a little too.
It's easy to abuse that.
Yeah. But the idea that with within that construct, that initial construct, that initial reveal of this is the world we're talking about, I think sometimes people do shit that's cool, that looks cool.
Right.
But how many times have you heard in a modern film, yeah, it was great, and then kind of stumbled at the end.
Right.
We've talked about this before. It's like there's so many movies where, it was great, except for the third act.
Mm-hmm.
And
writing yourself is super fun and great, but writing yourself out.
Why I think it's so important to, whenever you start, you almost start with your ending first in mind. It's like you. It has to be one of those. Like, the way I approach storytelling is, I've got a beginning and I have an end.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two stones that I start with.
Right.
And then the real work is filling in that gap in between. What is happening to go from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, not often, but sometimes, point B changes because of where you've gone.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to have that strong ending already in mind.
Well, it's like, would you go on a trip without a destination?
No.
Destination?
To be fair, though, a lot of writers that, and I don't know how true this is, but they say that they don't know. They just kind of embark on this journey.
That befuddles me.
I know. I don't work that way.
I can't imagine going... Within the framework of a scene, let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you bet, especially if you're doing stuff that's really plot-driven,
mm-hmm.
I think you better know where you're going.
I just can't take that leap of faith that I may spend the next few months working really, really, really hard on this.
That's how you get like 5,000 words into something, you realize, oh, I don't even need any of this.
Yeah, and you wind up with like this lost story in a drawer that, maybe someday when you're dead, somebody's going to pay attention to, and then some hack is going to finish it for
you. Or, I've done things where like I pulled a story out of the first book that just didn't fit,
mm-hmm.
And ended up selling it to somebody else.
It becomes something else.
It can
be the germ for...
I agree.
Which has nothing to do with supervillains.
No. But I think it's interesting, and I think it's the kind of thing that needs to be talked about. Because so often today, especially, and I don't mean to be the old guy on the porch, but today, you get a lot of people, they have their moments. Someone once argued that within a story, you have your, again, we'll use the word moments, and those are the tent poles that support the overall structure of your story. The writing part, the heavy lifting part, comes in that stuff between those tent poles.
Absolutely.
But today, it's just, you see a lot of movies where it's just, this is a cool scene, and they become set pieces that get strung together, and people think it's a story.
Here's another cool scene.
But it's not.
All right. Sucker Punch comes to mind.
Yeah.
That's a movie of just cool scenes.
Sucker Punch fails in the idea of what I call, they say, style over substance. But this I think is style as substance. It fails where something like Tarsem Singh's The Fall succeeds.
Right.
That works because it's beautiful, but there's also a compelling story behind it.
There is a far more compelling story than
goofy
this.
Shit. Comic name, Darkseid. we're going to cut up. You don't know any about that stuff, so we're going to move on. But for those out there listening, Darkseid, just know that we mentioned him. Just like we're going to mention people like Apocalypse and Galactus and Magneto and Venom and a host of other. I have a list of
super villain teams. Dude.
We can go over if you want to, but there's not a lot here.
I don't think it's necessary because fans know these already.
Well, we mentioned League of Shadows, League of Doom.
You know, the thing that strikes me...
The Hand, Sinister Six.
That makes a villain, any villain, super or mediocre villain, is that, with rare exception, Satan being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, even Satan falls under this. They think they don't think what they're doing is bad.
Oh, Hitler didn't think he was a shithead.
No. Yeah. Like a terrorist believes that they're doing good.
And that's what I'm talking about. That's that perspective thing and within the construct. It's the generic evil that we were just talking
about. Right. That's why
it doesn't make sense.
That's why books like Grendel are so fun and so fascinating is because
what a great book.
Or Hyde.
It's the alternative stuff. It's all this shit like Wicked that Gregory Maguire does.
You know, it's kind of become its own subgenre.
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take a small little character that doesn't matter and show the moment.
Show that world, that moment through their eyes.
Yeah.
Damn straight.
Here's another three that is gonna Cobra Commander. From G.I. Joe, supervillain.
Oh, bullshit.
Come on! The Foot Clan.
I know, yeah.
The Foot Clan from Turtles and Team Rocket from, Team Rocket from fucking Pokemon, I want to say.
Sure, yeah, Pokemon.
Same sort of thing, though.
Dude, who were the acrobatic car people from Speed Racer?
Oh.
Like, remember those dudes? Yeah.
The ones that Racer X was sort of... They was always a question.
Yeah, of like, whether, I don't know. Is he involved with them?
Ah, fuck!
Yeah. They would like...
Well, if you know, please go to the Facebook page and let us know. Or on Twitter. Yeah, there's always that again, Sinestro Corps, all that stuff. These teams, the Hellfire Club, which brings up Emma Frost, which you don't know anything about from the X-Men, kind of. You know, she leads this group of, like, as you have your X-Men, you've got your evil X-Men, and that was the Hellfire Club.
Would that be your O-Men?
Yeah, really. The funny part is about the Hellfire Club is that the Hellfire Club used to be a real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Decepticons. We're going to throw the Decepticons out there. Since we were talking Batman, and we mentioned Talia al Ghul, I'm going to say Poison Ivy and Catwoman.
Mm-hmm.
Have their minions, have, you know, they've got the, at least Julie Newmar always had these minions around.
Yeah.
Dark Phoenix is another one. Comic stuff, you know, you could not care less. But the funny part of it is I think it all, mentioning comics sort of brings up the idea of how sturdy the archetype is. And how heavily it gets used.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even in something like The Crow, you've got top dollar.
Yeah.
You know, who has his little kingdom
and has his, yeah. Can we just talk about, just for a second, Jason Momoa as The Crow?
Can we not?
Yeah. You know, okay. So on the surface, he was married to Lenny Kravitz's daughter.
Right.
He plays guitar.
Sure.
Because now the scenes...
Because Aquaman plays guitar.
Well, because there's all these scenes now. Snyder tweeted a bunch of... A photo of him standing there in his Aquaman getup holding an old 335. But... and yeah, he's got kind of a rocker look, which I think is important for the character. But he's 6'5". And like 280. It's like, there's no way you're going to pull off late lanky goth musician.
Well, you're going to have to, I mean, it's not going to be lanky goth music. It's going to be something completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
I
he's an MMA fighter.
right, exactly.
I have
different reasons for hating all this Crow reboot shit. But I know that I won't go into. I just don't understand why nobody made the, what to me was the obvious choice and the only thing that I was excited about when they started doing sequels, and that was the little girl, Shelley, becomes the Crow. That made sense.
Sure.
You know, but no, they made her, you know, fall in love with a guy who, yeah. You know, it's stupid.
It is dumb. It's like in the second one.
Yeah.
And in all the subsequent ones, the adoption of the Harlequin face paint
makes no sense. Yeah.
In the first one, it makes sense because of the role, something yeah. that his girlfriend Absolutely. Had given him, and blah blah blah. I always thought the second one, after the guy's son dies, there's a moment where he's kneeling in the rain and he's got a painting or something that mm-hmm. his son did. And it's watercolor.
Right.
So why not just press that to your face?
Exactly.
And that becomes the face paint.
Yeah. And
but instead, no. He's drawing...
There's a cool book.
Branding.
Yeah, branding. Brandoning.
Yeah.
There's a cool book called... I want to say it's... This is only a partial title. Shattered Dreams.
Yeah.
Okay.
The prose... Pro stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Which Poppy is Brights in it.
Which is a really cool idea, wherein, mm-hmm. You know, the Crow can be anyone.
Yeah. There was a whole series after that they did with, they had these great covers by Kent Williams and, mm-hmm. and Mirren Kim. And it was cool. There was a female Crow that
Absolutely.
Had an Indian Crow painted on her face.
Yeah.
And this has, man, I don't know how we ended up here, but...
we mentioned Top Dollar as a super
right.
villain.
Yeah. But every incarnation of this character is not about the face paint and the long leather coat. It's about an expression of some anguish, some horrible thing that happened. Each Crow should reflect that.
Absolutely. It's the classic ghost story where something mm-hmm. is unfinished. Something needs to be dealt with.
The avenging ghost.
And only this ghost has been given the tools to fucking carry it out instead of haunting someone else to try to get them. Go to yeah. this house.
Hamlet's father.
This. Yeah, exactly. And now the ghost itself can, like, fuck you, yeah. I'm coming back and
incarnate,
I'm going to fuck you up.
And then fuck people up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the beauty of it is, the otherworldliness part of it is... the idea of, you know, taking that kind of damage,
yeah.
the bullet through the hand,
sure.
and all it's that.
I mean, it's a wonderful fantasy for anyone who's ever felt wronged and who hasn't.
And it's no surprise that it found its audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
The audience that it did.
It came at the exact right time.
Exactly.
It's one of those examples of
lightning. Listen, we were there with the Carbonoctum thing. That was happening when it was just, in many ways, the release of The Crow had a lot to do with
yeah,
moving
absolutely.
Forward.
Man, I remember I went and saw The Crow, and I was like, this movie is everything that I've ever wanted. It covers every little thing
yeah.
that I like,
yeah.
you know. And I remember... driving like a maniac to Kmart where my friend worked and like banging on the glass and getting him to come to the front of the store because the store was closed.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, whatever you do when you get off work, stop whatever it was you had planned
yeah.
and go see this movie.
Yeah. We're going to get off this sidebar in a second. My one disappointment in the film, other than the fact that Brandon Lee died, was that you have a world-class martial artist and you don't let him martial
sure.
art.
Well, and I think they were trying to not do that.
But
because it made no sense for Eric Draven to...
No, but I think it could, especially when you've got Brandon Lee and Jeff Immata on set.
Yeah.
we could have had the Bourne identity then.
Yeah,
we could have seen at Filipino martial arts, and it would have made sense, not because it implies training, but it implies being really pissed off.
Right.
And
these nasty, gnarly fights.
Yeah, and not having any of the restraint of, you know, there's always
morality,
restraint. Yeah, restraint. Even in a fist fight on the street, there's restraint.
We've been shown time and time again that this character doesn't give a shit about this guy. He wants to fucking
what
break.
More can you take from this guy?
Yeah, exactly.
And that we see that in a lot of heroes and anti-heroes. They've lost everything. There's nothing else that you can... nothing else you can take for them. So why shouldn't they walk unarmed into the supervillain's lair?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The only thing at the time... Now I've warmed up to it. But at the time, the only thing I was kind of like... The only sour note for me was that we had this nemesis. Because in the comic book, Top Dollar was...
He's pretty easily dispatched.
He's easily dispatched, there's a car wreck, and then he just walks up and, we assume, beats him with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of liked that. I liked the randomness of everything.
Because it wasn't...
It got shoehorned into this, well, no, we got to have a main bad guy. You know, we got to have, you know...
Right.
And now, as I've matured, that makes more sense. And
well, as a film,
yeah, you need it.
Yeah, as a book, you know, I think the horror of The Crow as a book is that one, what it took to get there,
death
of James O'Barr's girlfriend,
yeah,
but also the fact that it was in many ways O'Barr's one shining moment.
Exactly.
It was this scream in an empty room, and there was nothing else. Because everything else he did, released subsequent to that, didn't resonate at all.
No, well, and I hate to be, I don't want to be a dick, but sometimes people just don't have anything, and it takes this, in this case, horrible event to bring forth something that ultimately is beautiful, and poignant. But had that not happened, would we have ever heard of him? No.
The art isn't particularly good, and the story is kind of all over the place.
It is, I tell you what, without what happened to bring that to life, I doubt if it would have been noticed near as much. Which is it's a sad fact that sometimes it takes tragedy to get people to pay attention to things.
Right.
It's part of the story.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Sorry.
It's okay.
I just had to bring that up. Let's see. I'm going to throw a couple more names out there. I'm going to stay away from... let's get rid of Green Goblin. Let's get rid of Loki. There's an early one. Supervillain.
Sure.
Very much.
Are you talking comic book
no,
Loki?
I'm talking,
or are you talking Norse mythology
I'm talking
Loki?
Just generic Loki.
Sure.
Let me get rid of some of the comic stuff. I got some ones I really want to get your thoughts on. Davy Jones from Pirates of the Caribbean. Sure. Minions, Secret Lair.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Jigsaw from the... No? Just generic villain.
Generic villain. I mean, he has no... He can't be a super villain. He has no influence. Again, unless we use that, which I'm kind of seeing now as kind of a cop-out. He is the supervillain in this small sphere of influence.
Well, yeah, but this is also one guy meeting out revenge on another guy.
Sure.
It doesn't
but
involve
I mean, like,
world
you know,
destruction. Or...
Is Michael Myers a supervillain? No.
Yeah.
Is, you know, Freddy Krueger, I think, qualifies because he can be anywhere. He can be in anybody's dream, anywhere in the world. He could. That's something I don't get. It's like, dude, you could be, like, in the head of a president, a la Dreamscape, right?
Yeah.
You know?
What are you fucking around with teenagers?
Exactly.
Right. Someone else argued Predator and Terminator, which, again, I kind of don't agree with just because it's so specific. And there's no grand plan there. It's just, let's do this thing.
Skynet, you know, I mean, if you look at corporations as a villain...
Here's a couple of, again, if we restrict the world, Count Dracula.
Sure.
Because he's moving chess pieces that aren't his.
And they're in Renfield. And he's affecting things. You know, he kind of like, you know, I've done everything I can here.
Yeah.
I'm moving on.
Right. You know? Yeah. Right. I'm saving that one. Godzilla? No.
No.
Agent of Chaos. Complete. Yeah.
He's an animal.
Yeah, doesn't, yeah. There's no, the only agenda there is to, I want to eat, I want to shit, please stop shooting me.
Right.
And stop dropping bombs on me. So, okay.
It's a mere coincidence that I am, you know, punishing you for your treatment of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
That's not me. That's just the way.
And by extension of that, the other one was King Kong.
Sure.
And I know, because again, chaos.
And I see King Kong as a hero.
Yeah, you know. Right. Exactly. He wasn't fucking with anybody. No. He came and
one of the greatest love stories ever told.
Right. I think we're about at the point when we deviate to the crow. we're kind of done. All right. So I think we've covered it. I mean, you start butting up against too many.
God, I hope. Like, somebody, like, sends us shit saying, man, you forgot about this cat.
Yeah, if you think about it, please. Send us a note on Twitter at bonuspod or on Facebook. Let's see. Do we want to talk about...
How about Napoleon in Animal Farm?
Yeah. Again, villain. The world... That world... You're restricted to a farm. That world is too small.
Yeah.
To
well, I mean the whole story is a metaphor, isn't it?
Right.
It's
like, right. It's. But yeah. But within the idea of, like, I keep saying construct, we're animals on this farm. Mm-hmm. Anything that's implied is for the reader to imply.
Right. Right.
All right. So we'll go to the supervillain. A couple things before we wind up. I've been doing this 366 thing and
right.
been adding stuff to it, and I've been watching some good stuff. But I wanted to ask you, and I want to start at making this sort of a question that we're asking people, is what was the last movie you saw?
Okay, last movie I saw, The Top Twins, Unforgettable Girls. It's a rewatch for me, as all things are.
Is this a porn?
No.
Oh. It sounds like a porn.
No, it's a documentary about this these two lesbian sisters. You're like, I'm telling you, it's a port. No. from New Zealand, who are in the 80s, began a career of activism and protest.
Okay.
And they're hilarious. Think of the Smothers Brothers, but as New Zealand
women. That's cool.
It's a great documentary.
Is it on, like, Netflix or...?
It used to be. It's not anymore. The copy I watched most recently was from the library.
Okay.
It's really good. It's very interesting and just fucking hilarious. These ladies are.
Right on. I saw something called Hair High. It's a weird Bill Plimpton cartoon. Involving. It's very sort of. Rockabilly 50s kind of music.
Huh.
The idea of high school popularity based on hair. It's Bill Plimpton. It's very weird. On the 3 things, the 366, I watched a couple other things. One of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Had
you seen it before?
I had seen it before. Uh-huh. I think it and Shaun of the Dead stand okay next to each other. It doesn't it's a little more low budget than that, but it was okay.
I remember when it came out, like, it got lots of good critical reviews.
It was getting the kind of reviews that the Farting Corpse movie is getting. Whatever that one's called. I forget what it's called. The one thing, a Radcliffe.
Right.
A couple of others, A Man Called Dagger is very kind of in this house.
Sure.
That we're talking about. It's one of the Bond ripoffs from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Features Jan Murray as the evil overlord,
huh.
Which is kind of bizarre. And then I had a couple of days where I went through a bunch of Japanese sort of sushi typhoon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And a fun one that I want to call out is Mutant Girl Squad. It's very much in that sort of meatball machine.
Tokyo Gore Police
kind of thing. Have you ever seen any of the Sushi Typhoon movies? You'll know what I'm talking about.
I have a hard time with those movies.
They're weird.
They're just so weird and fucked up, and that's why it's why so much of like the ABCs of Death, I just have a hard time with, because I'm like, all I can think of is like, okay, you're just being stupid.
It's a little juvenile. I'll admit that. Stuff like Robo Geisha and that kind of stuff. It very much feels kind of like, where's Lloyd Kaufman?
Right.
You know, very
exactly.
Trauma.
Yeah.
A lot of it is some of it's helpful to know, you know, culturally. It's an example of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
It reminds me of I saw an anthology movie that came, a horror film that came from Pakistan. And there was one story that had to do with otherworldly apples, which I had no idea what that even meant. But it all seemed very earnest and very scary. So I guess culturally that might mean something.
Sure.
And then the 5-hour Radcliffe, which I've seen once or twice before.
Right.
And man.
Yeah.
If you want Chinese costume drama, that's where you should probably start.
Yeah.
It's a big chunk of change, though. It's 5.5 hours.
Right.
So I guess we're good. Next week is the return of Steve Johnson.
That's right. That's right.
We had
unless, you know, something happens and he's not able to make it, but.
Right. We had a horrible thing happen last week. I don't know if anyone listened to last week's show, but we ended up losing a file. My computer restarted and we lost everything.
Like right literally in the middle of recording.
We lost about an hour and we were all really, really bummed and embarrassed by it all. But Steve's a good guy and he's going to come back and we're going to see if we can recapture that magic.
Absolutely. I'm excited because the Kickstarter is doing well. So you, what we're talking about is Steve Johnson, legendary effects artist, kind of an evil genius in his own right, wrote a book called Rubberhead that chronicles this time that we often hear about, the rock stars.
Yeah. It feels, I haven't read too much of it, but what it feels like to me is a toned down version of kind of Fear and Loathing in Latex Land.
Absolutely.
It's very much. Yeah. There's a lot of drugs in there. There's a lot of craziness.
There's a lot of the great stories that other people are afraid to tell because they still have careers and they're still trying to work within. I guess in that sense, it's kind of a tell-all. I shouldn't be talking for Steve, but the point is that it's this great look at the Hollywood effects industry. Particularly in the 80s and 90s, and he had difficulty finding publishers for it, and now he's doing a Kickstarter. He teamed up with Sandy Calora, who's had several successful Kickstarters with his books, and it's going to be a series of books. It's kind of like an encyclopedia. Amazing. Some of the behind the scenes photographs are just worth it alone. But anyway, if you haven't, if you don't know what we're talking about. It's in the middle of its campaign right now. It's doing okay. Go to Kickstarter Rubberhead or Rubberhead Kickstarter, and you'll see what we're talking about. It's amazing.
Yeah, what I've seen of it looks great.
Oh, it's absolutely great. I'm so excited.
So we're going to do that next week.
Yeah.
And we're starting to book stuff out from there.
Yeah.
You have anything? What are you working on?
I'm working on Bleeding Hand. That's all.
That's it.
Dude, August is partway over. That's September. October, that's it, man.
That's it.
And this is the big one. So there's a lot of shit to make, and really excited about it.
Right on. Okay, Heather should be back next week. And again, I wish I could tell you what she's working on, but it's very, very cool. Please go to Amazon and buy my book. It's like $4.99. You paid more for a latte. And if you read it, please review.
Leave a review.
Because those help. The show's on Twitter and Facebook and all of the other stuff. If you have any comments on the show, please let us know. If there's anything you want to see on the show, let us know. But other than that, we'll be back next week.
With
either Steve Johnson or somebody else. So that's Supervillains, buddy.
Yep.
So for the Bonus Material Podcast in episode 88, I'm Tom Carnell.
And I'm Langley West. Stay scary.